This is session 605, Inside and Out, NEH Preservation Assistance Grants for Smaller Institutions. My name is Angelina Altabellis. I'm from the Northeast Document Conservation Center, and I'll be the panel's moderator today. So just a quick word on logistics. This is a one-hour panel, and each of our presenters will be speaking for about 10 to 12 minutes. And we're hoping to have about 20, 30 minutes or so for questions at the end. So when a question comes to mind, just jot it down and, please ask away during the Q&A period. So as the title of the session would suggest, the focus of this hour will be the National Endowment for the Humanities Preservation Assistance Grant Program, or PAG for short, as we like to call it, and specifically its benefit to communities of cultural heritage organizations. So I'm specifically not saying archives, because in keeping with the Beyond Borders theme of this year's conference, the goal of this panel is to present a couple of examples of how the PAG program can benefit the full swath of organizations charged with preserving our collective memory, including but not limited to archives. Because as we're all too well aware, archives are competing for resources with museums, with libraries, with historical societies, and similar collecting organizations. And all of these organizations have similar needs and face similar challenges, whether that's having a secure, environmentally sound storage environment, disaster preparedness, preservation of digital assets, maybe legacy media. So these are just a handful of examples. But the kicker is that we're all in the same boat. Most of us are charged with the same mission, which, broadly speaking, is to acquire, preserve, and make accessible collections of materials documenting some aspect of our nation's history. We're all working diligently to fulfill that mission, and most of us, I think, are doing so on limited budgets. But rather than always competing, I think there are opportunities for us, for the cultural heritage community, to succeed together through collaboration. And one of the easiest ways that we can do this is through the shared experience of education. The NEH PAG program provides small grants to support just this sort of thing and a few other activities as well. They're small grants, but as our panelists will amply show, they can have a wide and, moreover, a lasting impact. So this panel looks at preservation assistance grants from the inside out. We'll start with an overview of the program and what the NEH looks for when it evaluates applications, and this will be followed by two case studies from recent grant recipients, each of whom will share their experiences with implementation, results, and outcomes assessment. So let me introduce our speakers then. We'll start off by hearing from Joshua Sternfeld. Joshua Sternfeld has served since 2009 as Senior Program Officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities Preservation and Access, Division of Preservation and Access in Washington. Prior to his arrival at the endowment, he served as Assistant Director and Postdoctoral Scholar for the UCLA Center for Information as Evidence and Information Studies Department from 2007 to 2009. Josh holds a BA in history from Princeton University and received his PhD in 2007 from the UCLA History Department. While at UCLA, he worked as a program manager for the first annual Archival Education and Research Institute. Josh has presented and published on digital history and its intersection with archival and new media theory, including the development of a theory called digital historiography. And you may have caught his article on archival theory and digital historiography in the fall-winter 2011 issue of the American Archivist. Next, we'll hear from Kyle Ainsworth. Kyle received an MA in history and an MLIS from the University of Southern Mississippi in July 2010. In January 2011, he was appointed Special Collections Librarian at the East Texas Research Center at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas, try spelling that, where he is responsible for the preservation, organization, and continued processing of over 300 personal manuscript collections, 125 corporate collections, as well as the considerable land, court, and marriage records of 8 East Texas counties. Kyle represents and speaks about the archives at public events and on acquisition field trips. And finally, we'll hear from Chris Erickson, who has been the digital preservation officer for Brigham Young University since 2002. At BYU, he has worked to preserve and to provide access to university digital materials, particularly through the Rosetta and Primo software systems. He's extending digital preservation to other institutions in Utah and the Intermountain West through a workshop supported by an NEH PAG, by training sponsored by the Library of Congress Office of Digital Preservation Outreach and Education, and also through local presentations and activities. Chris has an MLIS degree. He has completed the NARA records management courses, and he's been certified as a Library of Congress digital preservation trainer. So following Chris's presentation, I'll just say a few words about digital preservation needs assessments, some of the work NEDCC is doing on this, and then we'll launch into a Q&A session. So Josh Sternfeld.
Well, thank you, Angelina, for that introduction. A very eloquent summation of the PAG program. And what Angelina did not mention is if there's anyone who knows this program inside and out, it's her. She has been involved in, I guess, dozens of PAG consultations. So she is an amazing resource, and hopefully in the Q&A session and after, feel free to ask her questions as well as us on the panel. So I want to just mention, as Angelina mentioned, this program supports basics in collections care, such as establishing the groundwork for good preservation and developing the proper methods for access to collections. But before I discuss preservation assistance grants, I find that it is always helpful to understand the general organization of NEH. NEH is composed of 7 divisions and offices that award grants to a wide range of nonprofit cultural institutions, including museums, archives, libraries, colleges and universities, public television and radio stations, and individual scholars. Collectively, our agency's programs support activities that range from research fellowships to documentary filmmaking or exhibitions, to the cataloging and digitization of collections. There's plenty of information on NEH's website, neh.gov, which was recently relaunched in April, so hopefully it's easier to navigate than it has been in years past. But for today, I want to turn to my work at the Division of Preservation and Access, which is the part of the endowment that I represent, and give an overview of the activities that the division funds. Our division supports projects designed to extend the life of cultural collections and make them more widely accessible. We strive to cover every facet of preservation of humanities collections, from planning and assessments to arrangement and description, digital reformatting, as well as the education and training of preservation professionals. I would also like to make a special plug for our research and development program, for which I'm the coordinator, and which aims to advance the latest knowledge about preservation practices, standards, and access tools. You should know that our grant programs support a wide range of collection types and formats, which you see here, everything from books, journals, prints, photographs, moving image and audio recordings, decorative and fine art objects, furniture, textiles, archaeological materials, digital materials, you name it. So hopefully you see your collections represented in this list here. And you should know that the Division of Preservation Access currently has 7 grant programs. Unfortunately, we don't have time for me to go into detail about all of these programs, but I'm happy to answer any questions about them at the end of the session. I also have handouts not only for PAG, but for the other programs as well. So as Angelina mentioned, today I'm focusing mainly on just one of these programs, preservation assistance grants for smaller institutions, and as she mentioned, we affectionately call it PAG. So where does PAG fit within the broader assortment of programs? The Division of Preservation Access launched its PAG program in 2000 to help small and mid-sized institutions to improve their ability to preserve and care for their humanities collections. We see PAG as reaching out to organizations that typically don't apply to NEH, and we encourage first-time applicant institutions. In fact, the program is directed towards institutions that are often unable to compete effectively in our larger, more competitive grant programs. A PAG award provides up to $6,000 to help cultural repositories, including libraries, museums, historical societies, archival repositories, arts and cultural organizations, and town and county records offices to preserve their collections. We strive to ensure that these applications are easy to write, We ask for just a 5-page narrative, and your institution is not required to contribute cost share to apply. You can find the full PDF guidelines online, as well as sample successful narratives and FAQs. And in case you're wondering, the deadline is next May 1st, 2013. It's an annual program. To be eligible for a PAG award, you must satisfy a few basic criteria. Your institution must have custody of and care for the collections that are the subject of the application. You must have at least one staff member or the equivalent of one paid or unpaid FTE. Finally, you must provide evidence that you make your collections accessible to the public for humanities research, education, and/or public programming purposes. Typically, this is demonstrated in the number of hours or days that your institution is open to the public or the availability of your staff to appointments. So the most commonly asked question about PAG comes from the grant program's name. How do I know if I qualify as a small institution? We are aware that many small departments in larger institutions are responsible for collections care and may not have the same access to an institution's overall budget. As such, we don't have an institutional funding cutoff, but libraries, archives, or museums that are part of a larger organization, such as a college or university or broader library system, should provide budget information for their institutional or departmental unit. Now to the all-important question. What activities does PAG support? Probably the most common application to the PAG program is for the hire of an outside consultant to conduct a general preservation assessment and to assist in drafting a long-range plan for the care of humanities collections. This is typically considered the first step in developing a preservation plan and can lay the groundwork for developing strategic priorities and future fundraising activities. We understand that an assessment can serve as an informative document for stakeholders to make the case for the importance of your preservation needs and priorities. A typical preservation site survey would address building, environmental, and disaster planning concerns, review the overall condition of collections, evaluate procedures and policies as they apply to preservation, and provide recommendations for improving storage and handling practices. For example, a few years back, NEH made an award to the Atlanta Fulton Library System to hire a preservation specialist to assess a collection that documents the life of writer Margaret Mitchell. As is typically the case, a consultant visited the institution to assess policies, practices, and conditions affecting collection preservation and prepared a report that summarized their findings and prioritized recommendations. The library used the report to plan for future preservation efforts and successfully returned to NEH with a second PAG application to implement the recommendations, which is not an uncommon occurrence. The second PAG included the purchase of shelving, supplies, environmental monitoring equipment, a security camera, and staff training. As I mentioned, that initial preservation assessment would typically result in a detailed report with prioritized recommendations, and applicants can return to NEH support for activities that might include a range of specialized studies and plans. For example, you may want to establish environmental monitoring programs or develop more detailed plans for improving environmental conditions, lighting systems, or security or fire protection for collections. Hiring a consultant to conduct a preservation assessment is just one possible activity supported under PAG. You can also apply to develop and implement a plan for better storage of collections, such as these baskets and oversized archival materials. In the aftermath of natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, we have seen many applications for assistance in developing the resources and skills needed to cope with disasters. And a PAG can assist a cultural repository to develop a disaster plan and train staff in emergency response. And we find this is often one of the high priority items in most preservation assessments. And I think Kyle will go into much more detail about what one of those would look like. PAG also supports the purchase of basic preservation supplies, such as cabinets and shelving units, storage containers, boxes or folders, or environmental monitoring equipment. For example, Keeneland Library received two PAGs to rehouse collections on history of thoroughbred racing, including photographs, and these cartoons that you see here, created by cartoonist Peb Bullock. Applicants may also request support to send staff members to workshops and training courses that focus on the care of collections, or hire a consultant to conduct on-site training for staff and volunteers. We are aware that many small institutions operate with little or no preservation expertise, and these training efforts can assist in acquiring the skills necessary to implement the recommendations received in an assessment, such as proper methods and materials for the care of collections, digital preservation, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, and disaster preparedness and response. In some instances, these training efforts involve collaborations among several organizations in a particular community. For example, after obtaining their first preservation assessment, the Sunflower Library System received a second award for training in disaster preparedness emergency response for staff in five cultural heritage institutions located in the Mississippi Delta region, an area that is particularly susceptible to floods, tornadoes, and earthquakes. And it was good to see these institutions thinking collaboratively. The organizations involved were the B.B. King Museum, Delta State University, the Cotlandia Museum, and the Delta Blues Museum in Clarksdale, which is one of the museums I would love to visit at some point. Got a personal interest in the blues. I want to pause briefly on a new area of focus for PAG, digital preservation. A few years ago, we expanded the kind of training that PAG supports. We recognize that smaller and mid-sized institutions are under a great deal of pressure to digitize their collections, and PAG now supports essentially two areas, education and training, and conducting a basic digital preservation assessment. In terms of education and training, you can apply to participate in workshops in digital best practices, the care and preservation of digital resources, as well as training in cataloging and A&D. And I think Chris will go into much more detail in this area when he discusses his project. A basic digital preservation assessment can be the first step towards understanding the current condition of your digital assets and the steps that are necessary to regulate their long-term care. An example of a project that is currently underway, an example of a project that is currently underway comes from the Special Collections and Archives at the University of Albany. In this case, they isolated three collections of reformatted audiovisual materials, photographs, newspapers, and documents. The project is to hire two consultants from Lyrisys and the Bischoff Group to provide information about those digital assets most at risk, as well as steps for building a robust digital preservation system. You should be aware that we are not able to support the development of digital management systems or digitization or cataloging through PAG. We have other grant programs for that, including a brand new category of funding for planning projects called foundations, which you can find in our Humanities Collections and Reference Resources program, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about that during the Q&A. Nonetheless, PAG does support assessments of current digital collections and education and training that may be necessary to build such a collection. For many smaller institutions, a PAG award may be enough to establish the groundwork needed to get started with sustainable digital programs. So my time is almost up, and I would like to leave you with just a few helpful hints on what makes a successful narrative in PAG. Of course, I'd be happy to answer further questions during the Q&A session, but in particular, I would like to focus on our emphasis on the humanities significance and describing your collection. It should be no surprise that the humanities is at the heart of NEH's mission in terms of advancing research, education, and programming. The description of your collection, which should be at least one page in length, should therefore touch upon a few areas. You'll want to highlight any treasures of your collection, whether individual items or perhaps a thematic strength of one or more of your collections. We also expect you to provide examples of how the collections are or could be used by students, scholars, genealogists, or others. This may be in an exhibition or in support of educational programs and classroom instructional materials, or for research in a range of subjects, including how your collections might contribute to new scholarly interpretations. If you can cover these areas in detail in your application, you will be in great shape and well on your way to a great PAG application. The remaining sections of the narrative that ask you to describe your institution's mission and the work plan are comparatively straightforward. And of course, I'd be happy to discuss these matters further. But now I think we should turn it over to two successful PAG awardees. So thank you.
Hello, my name is Kyle Ainsworth, and I'm the Special Collections Librarian at the East Texas Research Center in Nacogdoches, Texas, and I forgot my university, Stephen F. Austin State University, and I'm presenting about a disaster and preservation planning workshops that we had in May. It was a four-day regional event, and it was funded by the NEH and brought 23 people from 11 organizations together to learn about disaster and preservation planning from a Northeast Document and Conservation Center consultant. My goal for this session is to explain my thinking at all stages of the grant process, conceptualization, implementation, and assessment, with the hope that it might be of some benefit when you think about writing your own grant. I want to kind of briefly provide a setting for the workshop, because if you're not from Texas, nobody's ever heard of Nacogdoches or Stephen F. Austin State University. So this kind of gives you a sense of where we are. We're in deep East Texas, pretty far away from anywhere, but it's a really great place to work. And this is the university I work at. So you can see it's not really a research university, but it is kind of an undergraduate, and we have a pretty decent enrollment. And then the research center itself has quite a range of different collections and materials. So, but I'm not really here to focus on that. I'm just here to focus on the grant. So getting to the conceptualization of it. And what this is just probably the eight questions I asked myself as I thought about, okay, how am I going to write this grant? So what are the topics? And in February 2011, I told my boss that I wanted to write my first grant. And this was my first grant. So she suggested a PAG grant to kind of follow up on a 2008 preservation assessment that actually Angelina conducted. 2007 preservation assessment that she conducted. And so she's, you know, what are the topics that the NEH funds? And I looked, I don't have the website offhand, but I looked, they have all the past awards listed. And so many of the grants funded by the NEH are preservation risk assessments, like Josh talked about, conservation treatments and equipment purchases. So I was kind of looking for something maybe a little different, a little more unique. And it's like, you know, very few brought a lot of institutions together for joint learning. Okay, so the next thing I thought about is what audience will the grant serve? And I wanted to target cultural heritage professionals, so like Angelina said, archives, libraries, museums in East Texas. And then, you know, what does this audience in East Texas have in common? And so I thought, you know, what are the shared challenges that East Texas presents? And the things that jumped out at me were that we are smaller institutions, that small budgets and staffs, and that the interior and exterior environmental conditions that we faced were all in common. So kind of like you said, with hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, all those things we face in common. And you know, everything that everybody else faces, light, mold, temperature, that type of thing. And then I thought, okay, well, what topic would best address these shared issues? And I thought with these two things in common, a logical grant program would be a disaster and preservation planning workshop. And then so I was like, well, what's the purpose of this? You know, what are we trying to accomplish here? And so my thought was, okay, I really want to increase awareness about disaster and preservation planning, but also encourage networking and possible further collaboration down the road. And then so got to who will implement this. And we'd worked with NEDCC before, so I ended up brainstorming via phone with their education coordinator, Donna Kahn, and took a couple times, but we worked out that we do this workshop series, 4 days, and covering preservation basics the first day, extraordinary materials like newspapers and scrapbooks on the second day, and then disaster planning on the third day, and disaster recovery on the fourth day. And then, so is there a benefit to the general public? And that's kind of what something he was saying is like, okay, this is for the professionals, but we have to demonstrate how the public appreciate this. So we decided to work into preserving our family treasures, public lectures. So kind of a watered down version of what we were learning about, so that someone could just bring in a photograph or a scrapbook, and Danya would actually end up talking to them for, you know, half an hour or whatever about what they can do with a very minimal, with their budget even being much more minimal than ours, to keep that preserved. And then, why will the NEH choose to fund this grant over everybody else's? And to me, it was kind of a question of being ambitious and being unique, and what's going to make it stand out. So I was thinking not just a local, you know, a couple organizations. I wanted to make it a regional grant. So I ended up finding every cultural heritage organization within roughly a 75-mile radius, and there were about 100, 125, and those were the people that we contacted for this workshop. So looking big, how can we, and with that type of networking, this is going to help us if there ever is a disaster or something like that. So I'm not really going to read all these things that we did, but pretty much I wrote the grant, it got it submitted, and we got it funded. And this is kind of the stuff we did for some of the stuff we did for publicity and marketing, and have a really great team. I definitely didn't do all this stuff by myself, but it's kind of some ideas for you as far as things you might do. The postcards, really great idea. Having a website and a registration page so that it's just clicks. You don't have to deal with them via email as much. They're doing it themselves. They can call if they have questions. And then here's just some examples. You can't really see it because I just did a couple screenshots, but we did have IT at the university create a web page and a separate registration page, and then we also did postcards, which, you know, you can get the PowerPoint if you really want to see the detail of it, but pretty much outlined the schedule, what it was about, that registration was free, so all right, I'm going to talk a little bit again about implementation. I kind of mentioned what our different programs was. This kind of just lays it out how many people we got. So you can kind of do the math. We sent out 135 postcards. The maximum was number two, actually, 24 registrants. But roughly about two-thirds of registrants actually ended up participating. And so, yeah, this is just a picture from our fourth day. It was pretty cool. It was a hands-on salvage demonstration. So Danya contacted us ahead of time and said, okay, do you have any books you just want to just immerse, or slides or negatives? And so we had about 10 or 11 people, and we completely took our processing room and put like 3M tarps over it and over all the tables, and everybody got to get a little bit dirty. It was a lot of fun. And we also did the public programs. Those weren't very well attended. We had some publicity issues, and it poured the first day. But for the four or five people that came each time, they got 15 or 20 minutes with a specialist. And so those people ended up being really happy. All right, the assessment part, I mean, that was probably what I spent the most time on afterwards. And, you know, it's a crucial element to the grant process. And this is just something that helped me as I was trying to think about about the grant after I wrote it, or after we'd already done it. And we did this little survey. I actually whipped it up during our first workshop. It kind of helped get a sense of what people were thinking about it. And there's a comment from each one about the benefits that people got from participation. And then I'm just going to kind of finish up a little bit by talking about the main strengths and weaknesses of the workshop series. Participation, I was really encouraged by the participation, and I'm kind of focused a little bit on the three below there. We had a geographic diversity, and that was really cool. 14 out of the 23 people that came between 30 and 90 miles to attend one or two workshops. A couple came for all four. One woman came from Houston, which is about 150 miles away, for the disaster recovery workshop, and so that was unexpected, but really nice to, you know, that she was willing to come that far. We also had experience diversity. I thought that was a really important thing. Participants ranged from graduate students and a docent with little or no training to new professionals, 1 or 2 years out of graduate school, to more seasoned people who've been around for a while. And then finally, the workshop series had great mission diversity. So the institutions that attended included 5 archives, 2 historical commissions, a historical house museum, a living history museum, an art museum, and a state historic site. So even though we didn't have a ton of people, we had a lot of people from different parts of cultural heritage organizations attending, and that was really nice. And I'm not really good, you can read the value in the networking part, but those were also very nice. You know, in September, I think we're just meeting for drinks and to kind of gripe a little bit, but they're at UT Tyler, University of Texas Tyler, and they're kind of coordinating to get everybody together. So it's pretty good. All right, weaknesses, and I think it's really important not to pull any punches when you come to assessing your strengths and weaknesses, and especially with weaknesses, because that's how you're going to grow. It's how you're going to move on. And so the biggest thing for me was my own leadership, because I was a program director, and I think the thing that I really took away from it was that if you're going to do this, you have to do it as a team. And that I didn't really ask for any help until an hour before the workshop was supposed to start. And so I ended up, there were 15 things that I was supposed to have done that needed to be done. And you couldn't tell it from the outside, but on the inside it was really chaotic. And if they hadn't been there to help me out, it would have just collapsed. I mean, anything from having the consultant's phone number, which I didn't have, to having the PowerPoint projector set up, which I didn't have done either. The other thing would be funding, or the second thing would be funding. One of the cool things I thought was that it was free, but it actually turned out to be kind of a negative thing, because once people had registered, there was no sort of financial incentive for them to follow through with their registration. And it turned out, I also didn't think of catering. So if I could do it over again, I would have maybe a $5 to $10 assessment per workshop for catering, because we actually ended up buying all that out of our own pockets, just ran out to the supermarket and got food and drinks. And I think that would have maybe kept the 20 or 30% of people that didn't show up, maybe they would have attended. And then the last thing is scheduling. If you look at, this is kind of the timeline for the grant writing, and you know, it's in spring 2011, that's when I wrote the grant. And I was like, okay, 6 months, if we can get this funded in December and run it in May, it's going to be fantastic. 6 months is plenty of time. But you can see between the paperwork and the holidays, that took up 3 months. And it took another month each to get the website and the postcards done, with all the university red tape of just, you know, secretaries and things like that to get it done. And then so by the time the postcards were mailed, we had less than a month before the whole event was supposed to take place. And so when you do your grant, I'd budget a lot more time out for publicity and things like that. We had issues with the newspaper running it because they didn't feel like they had enough awareness. And so I think in the end, we were very fortunate to have 23 participants, but you know, they came on 2 or 3 weeks' notice, and for bigger schools, that's going to be tough with budgets and things like that. So, if you have any questions, or if you want to copy my assessment report, it's really detailed. It goes into all this stuff a lot further, and it's already done, submitted. So, thank you. Appreciate it.
My name is Chris Erickson. I'm the Digital Preservation Officer at Brigham Young University, and I'm very glad to be here today and talk to you about the Preservation Assistance Grant that we had received. When we first began our digital preservation program a number of years ago, we looked around for training that we could attend to learn more about it. And we attended the Digital Preservation Management Workshop at Cornell, and we found that to be very useful. As the time progressed and others in the area around us expressed an interest in learning more about digital preservation. We had recommended that they also attend that same workshop. Unfortunately, for many of the people, the distance involved, the travel costs, and the workshop costs made it difficult for them to attend. And so there was only one other person in the state who had attended that workshop. At that particular point in time, we decided that what we wanted to try to do was find a way that we could bring that workshop to Utah so that other people could share in that as well, so that we could increase the number of people in our area who were interested in digital preservation. We always found that collaboration was important in this particular area, and so we wanted to get others in their area to be involved with it as well. But that was a little difficult in figuring out how to fund that kind of an endeavor. One of the things that we had looked at was a number of the grants through different organizations. We found that those were sometimes very difficult to work with in terms of the size of the organization, the matching costs, the administration costs, and the effort to write a grant. So we hadn't been able to do that until we heard about the Preservation Assistance Grant. The nice thing about it was that it encouraged those who had never applied for a grant. And so this was the first grant that I had applied for myself. Our library had participated in other grants with other institutions, but this was the first one that I had ever worked with as the program manager. It was fairly easy to write. There was no cost sharing, which made it very easy for us to work with that organization, but also with our institution. We weren't sure that we qualified as a small or medium-sized institution until we talked with the grant officer and found out that they were looking at our library or the section of our library, and so we qualified as a small or medium-sized organization for this grant. And in addition to that, it also funded the things that we were interested, the education and the training. So we looked at the grant and decided what it was we wanted to try to do, how we would organize that, what the activity was that we were going to ask to be funded, the collections that were involved. It was important for the funding agency, but also for us to understand what it was we were trying to do. Above all, it was necessary for us to understand exactly why this was important for us and what the outcomes would be, what we hoped they would be. So we decided to put together a plan and apply for the grant. The year before, we had worked with other institutions in the state in the Connecting to Collections grant, and they had done a preservation assessment in the state. We had contacted 463 cultural institutions throughout the state to understand more about the kinds of preservation needs that they had, both a physical preservation but also the digital preservation. And one of the things that the consultant put into the report was that it turned out that 88% of the organizations that were surveyed had no digital preservation plan at all. And so that helped us to understand the importance of educating people about digital preservation. And the grant, or this grant report that they had submitted, also said it was really important for us to look at some type of a program or a plan where we could increase the awareness of digital preservation throughout the state and to put in place a program that we could educate others about it. We needed to find some way that we could get some outside consultants and experts to come in and do some training and education so that these institutions could work with their preservation needs. So the plan that we put together was in two parts. The first was that we wanted to bring in this workshop to train the participants on digital preservation. We wanted it to be a hands-on experience where they could examine the problems at their own institution and look at solutions for themselves. We wanted them to understand practical ways that they could exercise the responsible stewardship for their own digital assets. And then the second thing that we really wanted to do was to put in place something that we could have an ongoing educational activity for people in the state so we could continue the discussion after the workshop was over. We applied for the grant. It became a reality in January of 2011 as we were awarded the grant by the National Endowment for the Humanities. At that point, there were a lot of other things that had to be done. Part of it was working with our own institution for their grant responsibilities for the budgeting and the reporting processes within the university. And there were preparations for the workshop. We needed to make sure that we had the places, the procedures in place for budgeting and the financial reporting, and then also to create and submit a final report. Once we had received the grant, we sent out invitations to a number of people throughout the area. This was usually done by email, through personal contacts. We created a website where people could look at and find out about it and submit a request to join us in the workshop. The workshop was finally held in June 2011, and we held it at the State Library, which was centralized in the area. It was in Salt Lake City, and so they participated as well. Before we had the people come into the workshop, we sent out some things for them to do. There needed to be some exercises before they came. We had, as part of the workshop, a digital preservation management tutorial that we had asked each of them to complete. There was a pre-assessment institutional survey, and then we had sent out a number of things that we wanted them to read before they came. We wanted the people to be prepared so that when they came, it would be a good experience for them. One of the things that we had done was, instead of funding the entire part of the registration process, was that we did charge them a fee, kind of what Kyle was talking about. We wanted them to be able to come to the workshop, but they needed to have some responsibility for being there. And so there was a registration fee, a small one for that, and that included two lunches for the two-day workshop. An important part of the workshop that I felt was not just the training by the workshop instructors, but during the lunch periods, we had an informal discussion with all of the participants so that we could talk about our own situation, what we wanted to do, and where we wanted to see this go for the state. And from that, we created a loose organization of how we could get together. Here's a picture of the workshop that we had held. We were fortunate to have a number of people attend that. We had 30 people from 19 different institutions in a two-state area. You can see kind of a breakdown of those people. Most of them were from academic or from state government, but there were others as well. This covered a large area from the farthest north to the farthest south. Is about 430-mile distance between the two. So we had people from a lot of different areas, though most of them were centralized around Salt Lake City. The workshop itself was important, but what we found was that following the workshop, it had a large impact for us and for the state. From this, we were able to create a core group of people who were interested in digital preservation and wanted to continue to work together in this area. We have ongoing preservation activities in the state. We have monthly discussions. Sometimes they're in person. Sometimes, because of the distances, we do this through Skype or email. We have brown bag workshops that we have started. And from this, we've had five organizations within the state that now have created digital preservation repositories. We are looking to extend this beyond just these larger institutions, but to extend it to all of the institutions in the state who are interested in participating. And the way we've done that is we want to include one of the organizations within the area called the Mountain West Digital Library. It covers four states. There are 16 digital repositories and 56 collection partners. And what we've done is we have tried to encourage this Mountain West Digital Library to include a digital preservation component in that. The overall benefit of this grant for us was the training and education that we received from the workshop. But beyond that, it was the impetus that was needed in order to increase the interest in digital preservation throughout the state. Thank you.
So thanks very much to Josh for giving us an overview of the program and to Kyle and Chris for sharing their experiences with the grants, the preservation assistance grants from start to finish. I think that gives us a lot to think about. Before we launch into the Q&A, I just wanted to say a few words about NEDCC and our digital preservation assessment and preservation needs assessment offerings. We have a long history of providing these needs assessments, and we also have a long history of support from the NEH, which we're extremely grateful for. Our mission and by extension, our work dovetails with the mission of the NEH, and more specifically with the PAG program to provide advice and guidance to smaller institutions with the goal of helping them preserve and provide access to humanities collections. Those smaller institutions are really our core audience. And we're committed to helping them move forward. We've provided guidance on preservation of physical, i.e. analog, collections for more than 30 years, and we continue to do so. But we also offer guidance on the preservation of digital collections. We can offer this in tandem with a needs assessment for physical collections, and we can also offer a more specific, targeted general preservation needs assessment for digital collections. So the general preservation needs assessments, you may be familiar with them. They cover policies, intellectual control, the physical plant, storage furniture practices, exhibit practices, the whole swath to really give you that 30,000-foot overview of the state of your collections care. The digital preservation needs assessments are kind of similar in that they cover the administrative infrastructure for digital preservation, looking at policies, staffing, expertise that you have on staff, budget, intellectual control, metadata, formats, file formats that you have in your collection and your storage practices. Maybe you have some materials on one server and others on CDs and still more on external hard drives. So again, the goal is to really get that 30,000-foot view with the ultimate goal of helping you develop a long-term preservation plan. So in either case, our goal is to, in either case, we really take the approach of sort of a good, better, best set of recommendations. So we provide information on and we make recommendations based on best practices such as they are within the field. But we also look at your unique institutional context, your staffing, and your budget resources to try to come up with short-term and mid-term and long-term recommendations that are really practical for you. So that's a little plug there. But thanks again to our panelists, and I'm just going to open it up now to questions. I'm just going to repeat the question since the session's being recorded. The question was whether the NEH PAG program allows for inclusion of indirect costs.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. We certainly see indirect costs come into play for a lot of our other grant programs. In terms of preservation assistance grants, I would say that typically, it's not common to see indirect costs covered. Most of the funding goes towards bringing in the consultant, the purchase of the archival materials, storage materials. Don't quote me on whether it's not possible altogether. I'd have to go back and check. It's a good question, though. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay, you had a second question. That's right. It was a two-parter. So the question was whether a PAG would cover a review by something like a facilities specialist to really target a particular need in an institution.
Well, certainly that can fall under the purview of the general preservation assessment. If you're looking for a more kind of targeted look at the facility and its storage environment, we do have another program that can certainly cover that, which is our Sustaining Cultural Heritage Collections program. That's sort of a two-level program. One is for planning, and one is for implementation. So the planning grant is up to, I believe, $40,000. and that is to bring in an interdisciplinary team to everyone from engineers, facility managers, curators, archivists, librarians, whomever is involved with the care of the collections, to draft a plan for implementing everything from updating an HVAC system to lighting systems to environmental monitoring systems. And, you know, certainly if you're just looking for that kind of, as Angelina described, that kind of more general overview of some of those systems, that can be covered under PAG. If you're looking to do a more kind of holistic approach to the facility itself, then I would certainly direct you towards considering the Sustaining Cultural Heritage Collections program. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the question is from someone from a museum based at a parent institution, a university, I think you said. The museum has an oral history collection that was digitized some time ago, not necessarily to standards, and so would an NEH PAG fund the preservation and delivery, access delivery of those recordings?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question, and you hit on one of the the keys is that you are a nonprofit organization, so certainly you would be eligible to apply. And absolutely, if your goal or intent with this particular collection is to perhaps conduct a basic assessment of the collection, its state, its condition, you can bring in an audiovisual archivist or specialist to come in to do a 1-3 day kind of assessment. That would look at things like, you know, sticky shed syndrome if you're looking at, you know, reel to reel, things of that nature. If you're looking for more advanced kinds of processing activities, that wouldn't be covered under PAG. So if you're looking to, for example, discover what's on those 2,000 recordings and to kind of get a better intellectual control over the collection, that wouldn't fall under the purview of PAG, and I would direct you to consider certainly Humanities Collections Reference Resources, but either at the planning level, which is called our Foundations Program, or if you're sort of prepared to go the bigger step, you could certainly think about at the implementation level, and that would be for sort of the non-basic assessment activities, processing, cataloging, and so forth. So the PAG, just in summary, the PAG would cover a basic assessment. If you needed some very basic materials to rehouse that collection, you can certainly apply for that through PAG as well. Mm-hmm.
I think since you're a museum, you would also qualify for funding from the IMLS, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, so you might look at their offerings and speak with one of their program officers as well. Mm-hmm. Other questions? In the front.
I have a question for Chris.
So the question was for Chris Erickson. Was there a point person at your institution who kind of coordinated the grant, contacted people throughout the state?
I was the point person for that. It was kind of a project that I had wanted to see happen, and so I had contacted some of the other institutions. There were three of us that supported the grant, but I would go out to the other organizations and get information about what their collections were like, how this would enhance their collection through the public access. And then I had each of them give me a letter of statement supporting what we were trying to do, but also people within their organization that they would like to see trained. And so that was very helpful. Before we even applied for the grant, we had had 20 people from different organizations who had agreed to come to the workshop.
Question in. The question is for Chris Erickson, and it pertains to the use of a couple of different questionnaires in the workshop preparations.
The first questionnaire that I mentioned was the collecting sorry, get it right, Connecting to Collections grant that had been done as a statewide grant the year before. I think that was in 2009 and 2010. On my PowerPoint, when that is available, it should be posted, I assume, there is a link to that. But you can go out and just do a search on the Utah Connecting to Collections grant. In there, there is the information about the survey that we had created that went out to the entire state. There were 463 cultural institutions we sent that to. When we were not the main person in that grant, we had been asked to participate with the University of Utah, who was the main person on that grant. It was originally only looking at the physical preservation mold, housing, and so forth. When they had asked me to participate on that, I said it was important for us to include digital preservation in that as well. And so we had modified that survey initially to include digital preservation. So that was already done before we had submitted for this grant. And that was one of the things that we used as reasoning on why the training was important, because there was such a lack there. The survey that we had done for the grant that I did was actually part of this digital preservation management workshop. There is an institutional readiness survey. It's kind of a pre-assessment that goes out and looks at where you are, what your needs are, what you have done, so that the workshop instructors can get an idea of the audience that they're looking at. That survey is also, I believe, available online if you look at the Digital Preservation Management Workshop tutorial. There should be a link to that one. If not, my email address is there, and you can certainly email me with that.
Okay. Other questions? I have a question, which is for Kyle and Chris. I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, there's a reporting requirement at the end of each grant. Can you talk about sort of how you handle the reporting, you know, sort of what that general process?
Sure. I think for me it was, because this is the first grant I've ever written, so it was really important to be really, well, for me, very critical of my performance and what had happened. And so just, and because I'm part of a team, going back and looking, okay, what did everybody do? I don't want to miss anybody. And at the time it was a little hard because I made a lot of mistakes. But in the end, just kind of focusing on the teamwork aspect of it. And it's like, okay, this was real good. And I think one thing that because we have the university has a grant office. And one thing they really liked about my assessment was the table that I did, which showed for the people that attended and the people that didn't attend, when they registered, where they came from, how far away that was, and how many sessions they wanted to participate in, color-coded, whole nine yards. And that was really helpful to see, okay, this is how far you got, is a way to assess how far we were able to reach.
The thing I found really important in all of this was to keep an accurate record of the things that had been done from the very beginning all the way through the project. So I kept my own record of who I had talked to, what we had done, what the planning was, and at the end, in creating the report for the granting organization, it was fairly easy to put that together with the information that they needed. Along with that, there was the part with the university, because they require a monthly statement of exactly what it was I was doing, how much I had spent, so that I knew how much there was left in the account. So it was important to keep up on that.
Okay. I just want to step in real quick and to say that, you know, I think the level of honesty and openness about the reports that both Kyle and Chris are terrific, but I want to dispel any kind of notion that we're not some scary federal government that are looking for you to go to the level of self-critique that I think Kyle went, which I think is fantastic, and it was a really good learning experience. But we're very open in terms of helping you write that final report, and of course we want a an honest assessment and the final outcomes. But every awardee is assigned a program officer. Even if you've applied and weren't successful, you're assigned a program officer, and we are very open to work with you in developing that final report, or if you weren't successful, to provide feedback for some of the reasons that perhaps your application wasn't successful, and we are very encouraging for resubmission for the following year. And we see so many institutions that might not get that first PAG award come back and write just a fantastic application and really take off after that.
I should mention as well that I found them to be very helpful in that sense. The program officer had contacted me before the grant was officially awarded and let me know what was happening and what was going on with it, and then contacted me throughout the project. When I had written up what I thought was the final report, I sent it in and said, "Is this what you're looking for?" And they said, "Absolutely. Here are a few things you may want to add or to change," but they were very helpful in the process. It was not a scary thing. It was very easy. I'd been very apprehensive about applying for a grant in the first place because I had heard from people horror stories about grant reporting and so forth, but this was not the case. It was very enjoyable.
We are out of time, actually, but we're happy to stick around and ask any questions. So please join me in thanking our panelists.